Welcome to Pediatric Insight, where we have candid conversations with members of the Child Health Advisory Council and some of the nation's top academic child health leaders. I am Wesley Milliken, CEO of Career Physician, and your host. Each conversation addresses a leadership challenge or opportunity that's top of mind for today's pediatric leaders. The council breaks it down based on the wisdom and experience obtained throughout their distinguished careers. And now, I'm honored to turn it over to the moderator in today's conversation.
Today's topic is how are full-time clinicians integrated into the Department of Pediatrics? This is a key question because of the increasing clinical demands that departments face and the difficulty of having everyone on the faculty chair in the tripartite mission. Difficulties because individuals have different interests, enjoy different aspects of the tripartite mission, and may or may not be geographically co-located. So it's a key question. How are full-time clinicians integrated into the Department of Pediatrics? So the first question that I'd like to ask Bruder and Craig to address are, who in general are these people? What areas do they work in? And what roles do they fulfill? Related question is, what percent of the providers are they? And what titles do they hold? So Bruder, if I can ask you to begin and discuss your experiences with this issue.
Thank you, Arnie. This is a area that really evolved during our careers. I want to first say that there are three types of clinical faculty. There are, at least in our department, there was what we defined as an academic clinician, who was absolutely part. It was a full-time faculty role, non-tenured, that provided clinical service, had no protected time for research, but did teach on this wherever they were practicing, and were very much a important part of an academic division. Then there were the community pediatricians who were volunteer, who were not paid mostly for their services, which I think is going to have to change, but critical in the education of medical students. They had the same title as some of the academic. They were voluntary clinical assistant and associate professors. Then there's a third type of clinician that may or may not have a faculty appointment, but is providing extended care for the academic department. And that is an area that's very challenging. They may be, for instance, in urgent types of situations, they're often employed by the hospital to provide extended services that the academic department's providing. They tend to be in things like specialty care, emergency department, or in regional programs. And it's really challenging for that group. That was the biggest challenge, because how do you incorporate them into the academic department, maintain the same quality programs, and make them feel part of the academic department, even though they're employed by the hospital and they're not really under pressure for promotion, but they want to be affiliated. Part of the reason they took that job was because they could be, say, a cardiologist in Alaska that was providing community care and still part of the Department of Cardiology. The number of academic clinicians is increasing because of the challenges of reimbursing. So the full-time faculty, a clinician educator usually has at least 20% protected time. And if you have 100 clinician educators, that means 20 FTEs that you're supporting as a chair. So the number of clinician educators has gone down over time to increase the academic clinicians, who are still very active part of the teaching and administrative parts of departments. So that it's the hospital-based clinicians that are providing ancillary care that is really a challenge to keep them engaged, to value them, and yet they're not employees of the department. So and they're a small number, but very important sometimes for the clinical services.
Thank you, Bruder. As always, each department has their unique way of addressing issues, and this is one of them, I think, that's particularly different among institutions. Craig, what's your experience with this full-time clinician?
I would certainly agree, Arnie. I think if there are 150 or 200 programs across the country now, you're going to find almost no program which is identical to other programs in terms of how they deal with this issue. Some of the issues that I've seen that really come to the forefront is that this is an issue that didn't exist 20 years ago and or 30 years ago. And it's certainly everyone that has it front and center right now. The issue of how much protected time one has to do teaching is critical. The full-time faculty at the mothership traditionally have protected time for teaching, for research, and even that has changed over the last 20 years. I think those physicians who are in the community are increasingly employed by medical groups that are closely associated with either the university or the health system. And that's something that has to be dealt with, and the covenants that they're hired under, how they're paid, is crucial. Most of them have become employed because health systems have found that you can't really direct their patient care activity and referrals unless you appoint them, unless you pay them, unless they are actually faculty of the group practice or of the health system. And that causes issues for the departments in terms of the academic titles that they get. Those systems that have had the most problems are those that have had the most unflexible, the least ability to be flexible with the academic titles that they give physicians out in the community. And that sometimes becomes a major stumbling block and can be a major issue in failure of certain programs that require high numbers of referrals, such as cardiothoracic surgery programs and pediatrics and children's hospitals and the like. And so these are things that we have to be flexible as leaders in pediatrics and understand how to meet the needs of our programs. Otherwise, we won't be successful.
Thank you, Greg. I think there is a key question here is, in fact, who should employ these individuals and to whom should they report? My own view and what we did here in Cincinnati was that the vast majority of the subspecialists were members of the department, even though all of us on the faculty were employed and paid by the hospital. They were members of the department and they reported to the division chief and ultimately to the chair. That, in fact, I think helped integrate and allow them to interact with faculty who had different diverse roles. But that brings up the second question, which how are the roles defined for these types of for these individuals and how are they compensated relative to the more traditional faculty who participate in the tripartite mission? How are the roles defined and how are they compensated? Thank you, Danielle.
So I'll step back a little. As you said, you've seen one institution, you probably have seen one institution, but I actually want to start with how are they compensated? Because I've had to deal with this both when I was a chair and when I was supporting deans to hire department chairs and their faculty is what the funds flow is. Where are the monies in terms of hospital monies that are streaming through and the medical school? And then the composition of those funds to create what the recruitment strategy has been in who you're supporting. So again, if this is unfamiliar to folks, it's because I'm going to be thinking in the institutions I have the experience. So there's the role of the physician scientist, the clinician educator, or the clinical researcher, and the funding that may be required both for startup as well as grant support that for most researchers who are going to be on NIH and other grants, CDC grants, that the bulk of this, you know, if you have startup of 2 or 3 years for a junior faculty to get a K or to get, you know, and then to proceed, that is factored into how they're supported. Now, I don't know if that's your question, but I think that the issue of hospital-based physicians who add to the clinical responsibilities is a complicated one, as I've seen it, where those physicians, I agree with, or Arnie, you said, to have them actually report to the department chair, because otherwise you have two different systems in how you recruit, who's controlling the money and where the oversight is. So I think it's a complicated system, in my view, that in terms of funds flow, in terms of the expectations for bringing in independent support, and the protected time for teaching, whether it's teaching courses at the medical school, which could be, you know, sort of, there are no EREUs, et cetera, but how you figure out the time distribution, I think, is at the time of recruitment, or if you're changing your system, developing some metrics of how you fund them, and what the academic promotion track is. So if you have folks who are tenured, there's a real clock on that in terms of how they're funded and the kind of expectations. If they're not on a tenure track, then it is on, you know, obviously the hospital sort of requirements for clinical time and teaching, which is linked to teaching residents, which is different from teaching medical students. So I don't know if I've complicated the discussion, but I was trying to add to it. And I think it is a complicated system, and protected time is becoming more and more difficult.
Thank you, Danielle. Yes, it is complicated. I absolutely agree. having said that, I think it's important to recognize that these individuals want to be part of the department. They want to be considered as teachers as well as caregivers, but they don't always want to write papers or do clinical research. And so we need to adjust and have a description of their role. And I think that's important. Lack of that creates anxieties and difficulties and comparisons that shouldn't be made. So finding the roles for the full-time clinician, I think, is very important.
Arnie, may I add one thing which escaped me that I wanted to say? You know, the way general academic pediatricians were dealt with was that they were generally non-tenured and did the bulk of the teaching and the clinical care without regard to scholarly work, which can be recognized. When I was division chief, I was able to integrate that in saying any research activities happening in the general pediatric clinic needs to give credit and attribute the work of clinicians who are contributing to the scholarly work. And there's a way of integrating that in a way that had been ignored. And it works. It does work. Thanks.
I agree with that completely. And I'll just give an example. As chair at Vanderbilt, I once decided to have a research conference. And so I thought all the people who would come would be people that were involved in research. Doing research is a major part of their job. The people who wanted to be there, many of them were full-time clinicians because of exactly what you say. They know they contribute, they want to contribute, and they appreciate the recognition. So we have some expert commentators. I'll start with Dr. Stapleton Bruder.
I don't know about expert, but I want to point out one of the challenges when one is looking at a regional program like the academic programs in Seattle, and that is the dissonance between the university and the health system or hospital. The university sometimes is very restrictive in terms of its willingness to provide academic titles to people who are distant or not connected to the department, at least it's in my experience. That makes it challenging for in a regional program. It's maybe different in a city with a big dense population, but the economics of pediatrics is that, you know, the percentage of children with specialty disease is such that a strong academic department in a regional program needs to control the majority of that market. And people want to be treated closer to their homes now. And there are competitors who will provide that care if you don't. So you're working with your health system to provide the care, yet the university is making it difficult to appoint them. As I think a couple of things, Arnie, that you've said were very important. I always insisted that they be part of a division, reporting to that division chief, and that I participate in their hiring. The challenge is that the health system or the hospital may have an executive that's in charge of regional programs that the people in the region may see as to whom they report. So I think it takes some diplomacy, but it's really important, I think, just as Arnie said, no matter where they are, that they feel that they're part of the division, that you give them opportunities to be part of the division, that you recognize their teaching with, you know, publicly recognize their contributions and make sure they're included in activities whenever they can. Now, it's more possible with Zoom and things like that to have them regularly involved. But there are some challenges between full-time clinicians and the willingness of the university sometimes to offer the kind of support that the department would like, but they're really critical contributors to the patient care and teaching of the program.
Thank you, Booter. Wesley, you had some comments?
Arnie, I've just been struck over the last 25 years, how it's evolved. I mean, from our side, the talent side, the side of it. I remember an endeavor Bruder asked us to do for him, you know, 15 plus years ago for a division that had 13 faculty that equated to 3 clinical FTEs, right? And I think that they were struggling to have the people who wanted to be all clinical didn't feel like they were truly part of the academic mission. So I've just seen that as it relates, Arnie, to the clinician track that, you know, it didn't used to exist, and things like that that have evolved over the last 20 years. But I think some of the unintentional things that happened where clinicians didn't feel as valued as academic, traditionally defined academic pediatricians had a big impact on that. And, you know, it's definitely changed today where, you know, many of the faculty are purely clinicians, and that's seen as a really viable part of the academic mission in some places. But I think it's played a role in how clinicians have felt in departments around the country, even how community physicians, you know, relate to departments. Some perspectives from having interfaced with divisions who are in desperate need of clinical capacity.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can all agree that it's changed substantially, and that in some particular areas, it's especially found. Emergency medicine providers, neonatologists, staffing level 2 and peripheral level 3 nurseries. So the number of individuals doing this is substantial. But I agree with your perspective of how important it is to realize this change is occurring, adapt to it, be flexible, as I think was stated before, and honor what these folks, what the clinicians provide, just as we do for researchers or people that's major focus is education. Greg, you have a comment.
I think that Bruder mentioned the need for diplomacy, and what that diplomacy may exist on many levels. Pediatric programs are different in terms of their needs of referrals relative to almost any other program in the medical center that you might be associated with. And that diplomacy may have to occur with the group practice. It may have to occur with the hospital. It may even have to occur with the medical school. But you have to be able to explain that the survival and the growth and the prosperity of that pediatric program is going to depend on the success in meeting those needs of the community physicians. And those needs of the community physicians, depending on your particular circumstances, may be different than the needs of the other physicians that the medical center is relying upon. And so that's why there's 200 different programs and 200 different solutions. But it really is important that you have a leader in pediatrics who can explain with a great degree of competence that difference, and to try and help to give as much flexibility as possible to meet that need.
Yeah, I just commented about this. I always found it helpful in those negotiations to have the financial data in hand, because that showed that, in fact, the entire medical center depended upon the NICU. and financially. And if the NICU wasn't successful, the medical center wasn't going to be able to do things. The negotiations can be nice and comfortable, or they can get a little dicey because it's so important to be able to fund these clinicians, provide the service, as you just said, Greg, and provide it in equally at every site.
There have been some really cogent points made, and I agree that the people who are attracted to these sorts of positions want to be engaged in teaching and advancing the field. And as several people have mentioned, making sure you try to incorporate them into some of the academic parts of the department are really important. On the other hand, I have seen situations where people relish having the title of being a, you know, clinical professor of surgery or whatever, with very little expectation. So it, part of that diplomacy is to also, as a leader, hold those people accountable. So if you're going to be, you know, representing our department or representing our institution, we need to make sure that you're in fact contributing to the educational mission or the academic mission or some other element of that. So I have, in our own, Bruder mentioned our university was sometimes very restrictive in the policies. One thing we did have to do every year for clinical faculty is we had to reappoint them. So the chair would ask me, you know, are the surgeons who have clinical appointments in pediatric surgical specialties, are they in fact contributing to the education or the clinical care or, you know, resident teaching or whatever? And I had to document that each year. So I think that's important.
Yeah, I agree with that. And those who do not fulfill those expectations can be very divisive. So I also think it's important, to, as I said before, to have a description of what the expectations are and to hold the full-time clinicians to the same level of expectation as all of the other faculty. Danielle?
Yeah, I mean, I know it's been said and we know this, but I wanted to read a couple lines from the Future Pediatric Subspecialty Physician Workforce. And this is the preface by Fred Rivera. And it says what we know, which is why we have to circle around a lot of these issues. And this is a quote. The United States does not have a pediatric healthcare system. We have healthcare organizations that have grown organically to meet the needs of our patients. And I just wanted to make that comment and suggest that perhaps some of our conversations as pediatric leaders who have been at this for a long time is where our contributions could be in beginning to think about a true national healthcare system for children. I know this is pie in the sky. It may not happen in my lifetime, but I do think that the kinds of things we're talking about relate to who is a pediatric professional and what is the team-based care? How do we distribute the clinical responsibilities, the educational responsibilities, the research, and how is research informed full circle by the clinical, which is something that I think is often missed, you know, that those clinicians have insight and experience on the ground that's really relevant to asking the right research questions. Yeah. So I thought I would throw that out, Arnie, as part of our thinking as we delve with this kind of question, how you integrate a particular health professional, a pediatric health professional within a larger system of a department, a medical school, a university, or a hospital system. I think we're going to have to get to the point of looking how we frame child health and how we put those pieces together.
Yeah, I agree. But I also think you're going to have to live a long time for that to happen.
I agree.
John, could you comment from the hospital leadership perspective about how to make this work in the best possible way?
Yeah, thanks, Arnie. And I do think it's an important topic because full-time clinicians, you know, in some ways, they can be the lifeblood of a lot of the work that happens in a children's hospital. And I think how you pair them with the academic missions is, it's not magic, but it's important. Bob brought up a minute ago the point that oftentimes when you're looking at private practice physicians, general pediatricians, and others in the community that want to align, that academic title is very important. And for them to feel like they're a part of that academic mission, I think it's vital. But I think from a hospital standpoint, having those clinicians that help feed referrals to other services that help cover some of your bigger hospital-based services, such as hospital medicine, even the emergency department in other areas, it's meaningful because by doing that clinical work, you're helping really support a lot of the academic missions that happen within the hospital as well. And it's necessary revenue that the hospital can then help support some of the educational missions, some of the research missions and things like that. So the hospital is always, I think, going to lean more towards that clinical mission just from the nature of what, you know, its fundamental business is, but knowing that it needs to support those academic roles and those academic pursuits in other areas is important. And so I think as a pediatric physician leader, sort of knowing how to partner with the hospital to grow not only the clinical side, but to also have the hospital help support research and education is important. And this is one way that you can do that.
Thank you, John. And I agree. It just emphasizes what we discussed previously, that how the relationship between the chair of the department, the pediatrician in chief, and the hospital leadership is so critical to making all of the missions work. We've talked about full-time clinicians and the change that's been happening over the last several decades because of the needs for clinical care and especially pediatric subspecialty clinical care at distant sites and in the community. And the need for us as academicians and as pediatricians to adapt to those changes in a way that integrates full-time clinicians into this system of both providing care, developing new knowledge through research, and educating our medical students and residents. That flexibility and the ability to integrate all of the faculty and providers is just so crucial to the care of children and to the future. So we encourage all of you who are listening to this to think about the best ways to do that, to communicate about it, and to work towards an integrated system in Danielle's lifetime. Thank you all.
Thank you for joining us for today's discussion. If you have a question for our council or have a future topic suggestion, please connect with us at pediatricinsight.com. The Child Health Advisory Council is comprised of a diverse group of emeritus deans, department chairs, division chiefs, and child health executives recognized for their leadership contributions in academic pediatrics and child health. The CHAC's impact is further bolstered by Council Specialty Advisors, who are active current national leaders in each of the subspecialties in pediatrics. Collectively, the 30-plus members of the CHAC bring unmatched wisdom and experience to career physicians' executive search and leadership development endeavors for its clients. Our council members include the following physicians: Bruder Stapleton, Christine Gleason, Craig Hillemeyer, Renee Jenkins, Danielle LaRocque Arena, Valerie Opapari, Bruce Rubin, Robert Sawin, and Arnold Strauss. To view our council members' bios, please visit careerphysician.com and click on the Child Health Advisory Leadership tab.